want to first of all thank them for visiting with me during the regular session, a special session. Each of them bring something different to their elective office. Of course, Dr. Schwertner, a business person, he basically will oversee the largest portion of our budget in health and human services. When it comes to Medicaid and what's going to happen there, Child Protective Services, what's going to happen there. This is the authority because he's the man who takes care of that. In the two times when we've had to sit down and have budget meetings and conference committees, Dr. Schwertner is always at the table for that very reason. So he brings a very specialized and deep knowledge when it comes to health care, which we as employers are very interested in. As mentioned, John Rainey was active in Austin before he was ever elected as a small business person, and he continues to do that now. He is also vice chair of higher education, so he keeps a close eye on what's going on at Texas A&M. And Kyle Cassell probably talks to more county commissioners and county judges than anybody in the state of Texas simply because you've got a district that looks like a congressional district. But I want you to consider today that you go through a bunch of small towns that are nothing more than a feed store and a post office and a traffic light. Well, that's Texas, too. And they have special problems that are a little bit different than we usually talk about. So Kyle can give us some insight when it comes to that. So with that said, of course, Harvey has happened since we had planned this. Senator Schwertner, if you'd start, tell me what you have heard, at least on the state level, as to where Texas is faring and where we go from here.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for your weekly grilling that you had. Judge Peters and Mayor Nelson, Mayor Mooney, it's an honor to be here as well with you. Big group. Thank you all for your attendance. Yes, Harvey, Hurricane Harvey, it is just a tragedy. And I am very, very proud of how Texas has come together to respond, to make sure, first and foremost, that we save lives and make sure that individuals that are potentially in harm are in harm, are removed from that harm and protected and found shelter and food. Looking forward, I'm very much interested to see what the president's going to do and Congress is going to do regarding federal aid to Texas and to those that have been affected by Hurricane Harvey. On the state level, it's going to be a significant financial obligation and hit as well between the governor's disaster money as well as the Texas Windstorm Insurance Agency and how that's going to set up for next session when we're already coming in with a shortfall of between $4 and $5 billion. Our budget in Texas for a two-year budget is this last session was $217 billion. So, large storms like this can have a very significant financial, physical impact upon the state. And I think it's a very important recognition that we do have an economic stabilization fund in particular for various serious events like this, as well as any sort of financial hurricanes that might come to us from our federal partners or internationally, for that matter. So right now, obviously, the focus is on protecting those lives and making sure that we get those individuals that are at harm back to shelter and safety. And I think Texas has been exemplary in their response.
Representative Rainey, I think probably we see most of your district on TV or read about it in the newspaper or hear about it on WTAW. But is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, not really, but I would like to say thank you to all of you folks that are here to listen to what we have to say, and I hope you'll learn something. But more especially, it's just so great to be at home after spending so much time the last basically 7 months in Austin. It's nice to see faces that we recognize, and it's nice to be in a place that we feel comfortable. I'd like to thank Clint and his wife for sponsoring this. It's a wonderful occasion, and I appreciate that opportunity to be with you. I can pretty well just say that Senator Schwertner has pretty well nailed it on the head about Hurricane, and it's a tragic event, and we've all been praying for the folks that have been affected by it, and we wish them well, and we will do everything as a state government that we can to assist them. And more importantly is the outpouring of friends and neighbors all over the state who have sacrificed to try to give things to the folks in Houston and Corpus Christi and all along the Texas coast. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Cassell, from an agricultural standpoint and also small town Texas, what are you hearing from your constituents?
Well, the good news, well, first of all, thank you, and prayers to all the families that have lost loved ones in this, and continued prayers to our first responders and all the civilians that are helping them work. Small town Texas agriculture will be impacted severely. I mean, I actually had my son come to me the night before and wanted to go, and I had a friend call and say, we needed to go. So how do you discourage that? One, you don't want to get in harm's way, but we went down through Fulshear, Brookshire, Katy, got as far as the Oxbow and the Brazos near Richmond Roseburg yesterday, and devastation is statewide. That you want and need to help. There's people that need us, and they need our water, our time, and the shelters, and food and water is going to be the key aspect from an infrastructure standpoint. And Dr. Schwartner alluded to the federal government's commitment. You know, as my first session, you all, it just pains me to go back to this, but being a representative for about 3 weeks and then having West, and you see how the federal government moves so slow. The state's commitment is to get that infrastructure back and running and get those schools up and running. We need people to go to work, and we need those children back in schools. And so I don't know if the three of us will have another deployment to Austin to make sure we can fund that, because I think Dr. Schwartner was quite clear. We're looking at troubled times ahead, and this is going to be a significant economic impact. And how are we going to help the Gulf Coast rebound? It's not Corpus, it's not Port Lavaca. I mean, we're talking beyond Corpus all the way through Beaumont, and then from the federal side, you're going to have Louisiana. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but for some reason, I want to be a meteorologist, and my son is down studying at A&M Galveston with Kelly Templin's son, and there's another hurricane on the African coast. And if you're following La Nina and La Nino and Nada, or however it goes, Dr. Mace with the Texas Water Development Board said this in our last natural resource hearing. The weather patterns are such, and the temperatures in the Gulf, you're not going to see that natural progression of those storms going up the eastern seaboard. They're going to get pulled into the Gulf. So batten down the hatches.
Sounds like you already are a meteorologist. You've been studying it. All right. This is something we probably would not have talked about, but if your home or business has been damaged by Hurricane Harvey, you should notify your insurance company in writing that you intend to file a claim before a new law takes effect on Friday. Even though the hurricane did occur before the law took effect, a claim filed on Friday or after will likely be covered by the new law. On Friday, the penalty for an insurance company that doesn't promptly pay a claim as a result of a lawsuit will be determined by a market value formula that is currently 10%. The former penalty was 18%. So there's an 8% difference there. So if you have a business or a home damaged by Harvey, this is covered under House Bill 1774. Representative Rainey, you have some knowledge of 1774?
Try to update you on that. First of all, I think they're absolutely wrong, that article is, or wherever you got that information. The method of filing for a claim continues to remain the same. The only difference is that the claim is required by law in order for the attorney to get his fee. And if he doesn't get his fee, then there's some, I mean, if he doesn't file that claim early or that pre-file it, then he may be subject to loss of some of his revenue. So that was the only thing that happened there.
Oh, so it's for the lawyers. Oh, okay.
I guarantee you can look around this room and you're going to find whatever lawyer is sitting here, we're going to find an argument. I heard a story one time.
On the front row.
I heard a story one time about a little old town named Sanderson down in South Texas, and one lawyer moved in, and he was having a difficult time making a living, and another lawyer moved in, and they both got rich. So I think that's why we have lawyers. But I think there's some real problems there with the interpretation of that law, and I think that we're going to be better off. And there's not a whole lot that changes other than you did hit on the amount of fees that can be recovered, and there's some methods of that if you don't recover exactly what over 20% of what you file for, then I think you don't get any fee. And then it's kind of graduated. So I think it was a good bill. I think there were something like 36,000 cases filed, a hailstorm cases filed in 2012. And prior to that, I think the high number had been somewhere around 700. And there's only 10 law firms that file 50% of those cases. So I think we can see what the problem
is. Okay, we see that. All right, let's no surprise, you look at your property tax statement and school districts are on top. That's the biggest number. School finance has always been a problem. And last summer, the Texas Supreme Court said that the school finance funding formula was legal but outdated. That's nothing new. I'm going to do a quick history for you. 1983, my A&M consolidated math tells me that's about 35 years ago. Mark White was the governor, and he appointed a special committee on public education to investigate the public education finance system. 1984 came HB 72. That's when all our football teams got bad in the sixth week, because that was no pass, no play. Remember that? Let's go to, let's fast forward now to, well, it was true. That's what we noticed. The Texas Supreme Court threw out a couple of attempts 9 years later to write a constitutional school finance system. The legislature finally passed a funding plan that was accepted by the court 24 years ago in 1993. The goal of that system was to attempt to prohibit wealthy districts from being able to raise revenue and provide benefits that poorer districts couldn't. 25 years ago, we got Robin Hood, and you remembered that. Since that time, school districts have banded together to go to the courthouse steps to try to fix the school finance plan. District judges have declared the plans unconstitutional 5 different times. The Supreme Court has ruled it unconstitutional 4 different times. This year, the House planned to come up with this idea to use the Economic Stabilization Fund. We call that the Rainy Day Fund to help school finance. That didn't go so well as far as the Senate was concerned. And finally, over on the Senate side, they decided they're going to put together, guess what, a special committee to investigate the public school finance program. So we're right back to 1983. Senator Schwertner, let's start in the Senate. The idea, it's just a giant circle. Let's start with the idea of the rainy day fund being used for a funding of school finance. And the Senate didn't like it. Did you like it personally, and what's your stance?
No, I did not like it personally. I think the Economic Stabilization Fund, you know, is supported, obviously, by excise taxes from oil and gas, and those are variable. And to utilize that fund for ongoing expenditures, I don't think was financially prudent or wise. I think there is wisdom in looking at school finance and acting on school finance. It is broken, and we do have right now a special window because we're not under the gun of any court order. A commission was done in 83 under Governor White at that time, and Ross Perot was the chair of that commission, and it did lead to fruitful reform of school finance. It is a difficult, difficult issue to deal with because you have over 1,200 school districts, property wealth districts, property poor districts, rural, urban, those with high percentages of economically disadvantaged students. And each member of the legislature, in particular, I think each member of the House, because they have a much more focused view, I think, of that, how it affects their districts. Whereas myself, I have 270,000 school-aged children, K through 12, so I have pretty much all varieties of school districts, but there are some rural legislators or some just urban legislators in the House, and so that affects the way they view school finance maybe a little bit more than House senators will view school finance. It needs to be reformed. We need to look at how much we're putting into school, into schools, but right now the total amount is close to $10,000 per school-age child. And if you look at other states, for instance, there are some states that have higher test scores and higher outcomes but have actually less money that's actually put in school finance. And there are other areas, New York and Washington, D.C., for instance, that have over $18,000, and their outcomes are far inferior than Texas's. So if you look at our actual state rankings, we're doing pretty well from graduation rates, for instance. So we need to look at it, but utilizing, back to your original question, utilizing ESF money, I think, was not the proper role of the ESF, and I don't think it was the right, I think stopping that from a Senate standpoint as well as from my own personal standpoint was the right thing. Going forward, the commission's there. We need to look at how much we're paying our teachers, making sure that they are rewarded for their merit, for being good teachers. We as a Senate try to do that this in special session, trying to put in some sort of bonus structure for teachers and try to also increase their base pay, only supposedly 32% of total education funding in Texas actually goes to the teachers. I want to see that actually increase to make sure that we're driving money into those that are directly affecting the quality of the education. If you look at our total budget, our general revenue budget, $107 billion, 52% of our GR money is actually going to education, either primary or secondary education, higher education. So it's not like we're not spending money. It's how we're spending it and what we're expecting. And we need to continue to look at it because it's one of our highest priorities and obligations and constitutional priorities.
52% is a great number, but does that call into question what kind of quality we're getting on the outside? What is our return on investment, in your view?
It certainly does. I don't mind spending money. I just want the outcome. I want to see that money put to work, and I think that is most directly affected by having that money go to the teachers that are affecting the outcomes and providing that educational enrichment for our students.
Okay, Representative Cassell, you were in favor of using rainy day fund money to supplement in the House bill. Were you in favor of that?
Yes, and I mean, everybody goes back to the Constitution. We've got to balance our budget and provide the best public education we can. I, too, have 32 ISDs. I have two that are failing, Marlin, Hearn, and then I've got three that were, and I'd say dependent, they went into a deal with the government or the state on ACOTAR funding. And
explain what ACOTAR is.
ACOTAR, one of those fun acronyms. But
I wrote it down someplace so I'd have it. But the idea is that it's a small school district,
correct,
that just doesn't have the ability to be able to have sufficient funding to do what they need to do. Is that fair?
That's one way to look at it, and that affects three schools in particular, Bremond, Franklin, and Grosbeck. So if you look at those three schools in my district, Franklin, which I was visiting with a parent of a Franklin ISD student here a minute ago, they look to lose $7 million. Grosbeck was at $4 million, but with the hardship grant, they're going to be closer to losing only $1.5 million. They also had a school board meeting and raised their tax. I mean, it's important. I think Chairman Huberty had a good opportunity when we talk about ESF for public education. We put a floor on it at 7.5. We decided as a legislative body we wouldn't go below $7.5 billion. Huberty had a part of HB 21 that everything over $10 billion would flow into public school finance. And to me, that makes sense. I mean, how much money are we going to leave on the sideline? Is our bond rating stabilized at a certain level? Where is that? And who's going to determine, you know, that's what bothered me being in legislature the last three sessions is we can never agree on when to spend the ESF and how long we're going to leave that money on the sideline. I mean, we argue right now it's raining, school children are in jeopardy, schools are in jeopardy closing. You and I talk about small towns. It's all about water infrastructure and that school. And when that school closes and there's no water, that town is dead. I mean, Bremond closed the paper after 95 years. I mean, where are we? And they stand to lose $2 million from ACOTAR funding.
State Representative Rainey, the governor endorsed legislation that would increase teacher pay raise statewide by $1,000 and would give school administrators flexibility. Did you vote for the plan that was sent over to the Senate that they did not like? And what did you like about it? And why is it a good plan, if you did?
My concern with the lieutenant governor's plan was that there was no money. He was expecting it to come from the school districts from savings. And when I talked to my school superintendents, they were all concerned. You know, they think they're running on a tight budget anyway. I really think that in the end, we need to put more and more pressure on the local folks to run their school districts. I think they know more about what's going on in Bryan and College Station than folks in Austin. So I would really believe that if we put more emphasis on local control and local control of the money and local control of the education, we'll get better outcomes than we are by trying to dictate it from Austin with the TEA. I'll also say that the testing is out of hand, and the cost of that testing is out of hand.
Out of hand in what way?
Too much, too costly. And I know that I'm old, and I remember some old things, but when I was in school, we took the Iowa test of basic skills. That's the only test we took until we took the SEC, the College Board and all that.
There's the CEEBs for us back then,
right.
If you're that old, you remember that.
But it worked. I'm not saying it would work today, but I think that we're way overboard in the testing. We need to be thinking about teaching. And I think the local folks have a better idea how to do that. And they need to be in more control of their taxing. And frankly, if there are folks in Bryan and College Station who do not like the taxing that takes place by city, the county, or the school district, I think it's their responsibility to be a participant in local government and complain to them, not to the legislature.
Now, you didn't mention his name, so it's a name not spoken. It's the lieutenant governor. His name's Dan Patrick, in case y'all don't know who he is. You're in an unusual situation, Senator Schwertner, because you served in the House when Joe Strauss was Speaker of the House, and now you serve in the Senate where there's Dan Patrick. Compare and contrast those two people for me. Well, you're the only one in the room who can answer it, right?
Yeah, I think the papers present a pretty clear picture. There's, I served in the Senate with Senator Dan Patrick, and at the time I was the first senator that supported him for lieutenant governor. I'm obviously one of his lieutenants. I'm chair of a health committee. I'm chair of the subcommittee on finance that writes the health portion of the budget. So, and I'm on the conference committee and close in a way that advises the lieutenant governor. He is a conservative standard bearer. He's never apologized for being that. He ran on property taxes and border security and school choice, and he got 20% margins on the Democrat. And he won in a four-way primary. And I think the people understand where he is philosophically. The Speaker of the House is elected in a different manner. He is not elected by the people of Texas. He is elected by 150 individuals and needs 76 votes to become Speaker of the House. He came to power by essentially the entire Democrat caucus and, at that time, 11 Republicans banding together to elect him as Speaker of the House. And he has been very savvy in maintaining the speakership by how he utilizes his powers of appointment of chairs as well as support of individuals to maintain his speakership. And that's exactly what you got to do to win a race, right? I mean, if your constituency is the people of Texas, you're going to talk to them. Your constituency is the 150 members of the, or 149 other members of the House of Representatives, you're going to talk to them. And so he has to balance his obligations to maintain his speakership. He does not seem to have a large philosophical bent, other than he has been very vocal about transportation issues in the past and economic vitality being one of the keystones and bedrock issues that Texas needs to continue to protect. And so he has governed when he has taken an active participating role, and he did so more this session than in past sessions, with those things in view. So, I have no animosity to the speaker. I actually consider him and Julie, his wife, a friend, and my wife actually is friends with Julie. I like the guy. It's just, where are we going to head into the future from a standpoint of a whole host of issues, economic issues, social issues, and where do you want to lead? So you have two diametric individuals in the same party. One is certainly more moderate in social issues and actually I think more moderate in physical and economic issues, and one is much more of a conservative standard bearer. That's my contrast.
Okay, Representative Cassell, you get to defend your guy now. Tell us what Joe Strauss is to you from your point of view on the floor.
Well, let's be clear. The Speaker of the House has been elected by all 150 members of the House the last two times. True gentleman, he leads at the will of the House. There's 149 different personalities with 149 different districts, and he allows us to move as we should, which is, in my opinion, leadership. It's not his business or his ideological outlook. You know, we have a set of rules that we follow. You know, everybody asks questions about calendars committee all the time, but we have certain amounts of time to lay out bills.
Just a minute. Calendars committee will assign when bills will be heard. Is that correct?
Okay. But and the committee,
right.
And you have a committee chairman that has been placed in that, but that's his committee. And the speaker sits back and lets the House members run the House. And to the senator's point, we touch our superintendents, our county judges, our mayors more than they do. You know, I was in Waco the other day and they asked a similar question. And I said, I have five Republican county judges that I work with and listen to. And they did not like the property tax bill. They were okay at 6%. I didn't mean to go there, but
that's all right.
You know,
that's all right.
That's where we live, and
they
that's
were
who
okay
we work
at,
with.
Go ahead. They were.
They
okay.
were. They could stomach 6%. We'll say it that way. I don't think I look at one. I'm sure he wasn't thrilled about it. But you know, we don't need to hobble them. But the speaker, the true gentleman, lets the House go the direction the House needs to go. The Senate has the ability to change the rules. They did the following session, and it's a simple majority. And I would argue that Dan Patrick has ruled with a different – I mean, Bob Bullock is not even mentioned as a bully anymore. We'll just say it that way.
Well, if you're an old guy like I am, you remember the days when there were Ralph Yarborough Democrats and there were John Connally Democrats, which were probably really Republicans, just you couldn't get elected.
Can I make one more
Please,
comment?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So and you'll probably go to the caucus meeting. The fun thing about the Republican House caucus meeting the other day, you got to put this in perspective. We were talking about how is a Republican speaker elected. And the only two Republican speakers of the House were sitting in that room. I mean, you got to realize Tom Craddock and Joe Strauss are the only two Republican speakers of the Texas House since Reconstruction. Is that correct?
That's right. That's
and I was not here.
That's John Rainey, a former chairman of the Republican Party in Brazos County. You've been a Republican as long as I've known you. So now, again, referencing those two kinds of Democrats, do we now have two kinds of Republicans? And what's the future of the Republican Party in Texas if that's the case?
I think we do have two kinds of is that thing on?
It is.
Okay. I think we do have two kinds of Republicans. We have Republicans who've been around a long time, and then we have Libertarians who have joined the Republican Party. And I think that's somewhat of a problem. People want things to change right now, and it's not going to happen. It took us 60 years to get where we are today, at least, and maybe 150. It's going to take 60 years to get back to where we were 60 years ago if we want to do that. Government does not work fast. And it's for a reason, because we don't want drastic change in our government. So I think that yes, we do have some elements in the Republican Party that are somewhat similar to. I don't think we have any liberals in the Republican Party. Maybe one, but we do have more moderates than we do ultra conservatives in the House, and that's I think why the House operated the way it does. To speak a little bit about Joe Strauss, I'm going to join with Kyle Cassell. He is a true gentleman, and he does let the House run itself. He has told me over and over and over again that when you vote your district. You don't vote the way I tell you to, because I'm not going to tell you. You vote your district. And that's what I have tried to do in the three terms that I have been on the floor. I truly like him. I think that the House is, and I'm not trying to be ugly to Senator Schwartner because he's my friend also, but I think the House was the adults this session and kept government running, where the Senate was trying to, in my opinion, cut government to the bone. And it's interesting when you have a lieutenant governor who wants to fund $1,000 for school teachers, but doesn't offer any place to get the money. And I thought that was rather out of line. I was also rather concerned when I watched his speech at the last of the day of session, after the session closed, and he really lambasted the Speaker Strauss and said, well, if he was at the Alamo, he'd be first person over the wall. I think that was on call for. And I know politics gets hot, and people sometimes say things they wish they hadn't said. I may have just done some of that. I don't know.
He may have been.
I thought that was a rather less than generous way of speaking to a fellow member of the legislature who is a really wonderful person. So it bothered me.
Did you have something else you wanted to add? Okay, all right. So, and you're right. He said that. He called Joe Strauss a spending liberal and thought he was trying to put together a state income tax, and that did not happen. So now we're going to drag this 600-pound gorilla into the room. It's anecdotal. People call me from time to time and say, hey, why are they doing this? Why are they doing that? And time after time, I got callers going, why are you spending so much time on a bathroom bill in Austin when we have real work to get done? I'll let you start.
Certainly.
Nope.
Can you hear me?
There we go.
Okay. If y'all recollect, the issue was brought forth by the Obama administration when an executive order was sent down by the Department of Justice, Department of Education, that instructed school districts across the nation to mandate that students should be allowed to utilize the bathroom of their identified gender. Historically, it was identified their sex. Identified gender would mean whatever identity that individual essentially chooses at that time. And so that is, I think, brings into consideration some issues of privacy and dignity of individuals when they're in private settings. And so that is concerning to have a situation occur in which individuals could utilize, for instance, a female's bathroom just because they identified as a female that day. And I think if you really think about it, if you have children or grandchildren and you have, you know, granddaughters that are 12 or 13 or 14, do you really want males to come into their changing rooms and dressing rooms and bathrooms just because they identify as a female? I think there are ways to handle situations like this, and school districts have been doing a decent job of that over the years. But the Obama administration, again, brought it to the forefront and pushed it as a social war type of issue. And we had to respond. And I think the bills that were put forth would allow, would mandate, actually, individuals utilize the bathroom of their sex with accommodations for those that were transgender and with private, separately locked facilities. I think that's a reasonable compromise. However, it was taken by media and turned into the bathroom bill and made to be kind of a very divisive issue. But if you really think about it, it's about privacy and dignity in private settings and maintaining kind of the social structure of male and female in our society.
It never came to the House floor because the Speaker said he just didn't think it was important. So I want to give both of you an opportunity to respond. Oh, sure.
I'd like to add, you know, the bringing to the floor and under the will of the House, there were 20 special items that Governor Abbott, 9 of those were not actually addressed, including teacher pay raises, for instance. Merit bonuses were 2 of the 19 or 20. And so, yes, the will of the House, but then there are ways to not allow the will of the House to actually happen by not allowing bills to be heard or brought forth. But that is. One way to keep control of certain issues is to appointment of committee chairs as well as various committees, in particular the committee that does the scheduling for the bills.
Are we going to see it again in 2019?
It's historically been the way to control the House with your constituencies that are so varied.
No, I'm saying, will the Senate bring it up again? I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in the House.
I don't have the foresight to really tell you that. I think someone will file that bill. Yes.
Okay. Your thoughts on that bill, even though it did not come to the House, I'm sure our business people would like to hear your thoughts.
Well, first of all, I don't know anyone in this room that wants a man going into a lady's room or a woman going into a men's room, although I've seen it at Aggie football games. I think all of us feel the same. We feel like there should be privacy when you go into a restroom. I'm not sure another law would make any difference. That would be my concern. I think local school districts are probably capable of handling the situation on their own. If someone were to violate your privacy, and I did hear of one case where some gentleman was in a lady's room, maybe he wasn't a gentleman, but a man was in a lady's room, and he took his camera and he kind of held it up over the wall and took a picture. Well, he was caught. and he was punished by the privacy laws that currently exist. So I didn't see any need for another law to govern privacy. I think there are sexual assault laws that are there should that occur, and I couldn't find any instance where there was a sexual assault that had occurred in a restroom. So I felt like it was a law that really didn't accomplish much. Did I agree with the concept? Absolutely, I agree with the concept. I don't think men ought to be in women's rooms. So from that standpoint, I was glad the bill never made it to the floor, because I didn't see any reason to vote on something that I didn't think would solve any issue. So that's the way I feel.
Okay. Anything else that you want to add, Representative Cassell?
I'll be real quick. One, I want you all to know this. We banter a little bit. Our offices and our relationship between the senator and Rainey's office and mine are perfect. Bathroom bill, yes, privacy for women and children is of the utmost importance. It's the perception. The bill took away a patchwork across the state, but that is not what was reported, and that's where the problem ensued. We had a unfriendly business, wave come over the state to where this was going to affect. I mean, you know, my favorite was Jerry Jones. I did not build this new stadium not to host a Super Bowl. And those potential economic downturns, we couldn't handle. And it was strictly a business decision from the state. The bill was taken out of context, and that's one thing we deal with every day. Is it, you know, I quote Mrs. T, don't tell me what the bill say, tell me what it do. But most people, the perception, and you got to know Mrs. T,
yeah,
and that went over everybody's head, yeah, but it was the perception of what the bill was going to do, and that was not going to happen. I mean, when we go back in 19, and I say we, I hope all three of us are there, we're looking at, and the two finance guys can tell you this, we're already looking at an $8 billion hole, and that is not appetizing to me. So we didn't need any knockdown before we got there from an economic standpoint, bringing businesses and companies and investment into Texas.
Okay, short answers now, because we've got to cover a couple of more things. Senator, how much is in the Economic Stabilization Fund, the Rainy Day Fund, and what are appropriate uses in your view?
$11 billion is what is anticipated to be in the Economic Stabilization Fund. Certainly disaster relief, squaring the budget. If there is a shortfall, and looking into next session, I think there is going to be a significant shortfall with the supplemental appropriations bill going to be $3, $4, $5 billion. Those are very valid issues. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay. Representative Rainey.
Economic Stabilization Fund could have been used for public education. There is nothing anywhere in the law that created it that would indicate it is even considered for, and not to say it's not considered, but that it is intended, as some would say, for a disaster such as an earthquake or a hurricane. It has been used multiple times and taken down to zero to do things that the state needed at any one time. I think education, particularly public education, is very important, and I would have supported that. I would also say that in the public education sector, we need to be very careful, and if you've been watching the news, they're very concerned in the areas that have been affected that we don't have enough tradesmen available to make the repairs in the areas that have been affected by this hurricane. What are we doing with education? We're not training those folks. Average age for a plumber is something like 62 years old. I don't know too many 62-year-olds that want to do that kind of work anymore. So we need to be very careful with what we do. TSTC is absolutely a fabulous place. Blinn and the other community colleges are trying to make vocational and technical training a part. But in this case, we need people that can do trades, and we're going to need them for a long time. And so I would say that if we were to do something about trades, I would support spending Economic Stabilization Fund for that.
Representative Cassell.
Education is the key. We educate our kids from pre-K on through workforce training, gives them the opportunity and economic opportunity to be successful, and that's where we need to spend the money. That closes down all the shortfalls we have. when we're uneducated and we don't have a skill set to work, then we become a burden on society. We've got to invest in these kids when they're young and give them the tools to be successful. And that's what we're supposed to do. And then we can start looking at all the other opportunities we have to bring other economic opportunities to this great state.
Okay, we need to run through a list of things that did get done. The sunset bills were passed so the Texas Medical Board would continue. Mail-in ballot fraud, abortion, I want to talk about that again in just a minute. Increased retirement benefits for teachers. Also, school finance commission was put together. The tree cutting regulations, by the way, that my elected officials say, leave us alone. Let us do what we want to do. I'm just, you know, kind of letting you know they prefer if you let them decide here in Bryan College Station. And some DNR and also the maternity mortality rate. I want to mention abortion just a minute because how many, three, four pieces of legislation, Senator, having to do with abortion? Is that correct?
There were a number of pieces of legislation that were consolidated in Senate Bill 11, which I was the primary author. They were the bill started out as the bill regarding fetal tissue donation, and many of y'all might recall some troubling videos that brought to light some lack of oversight regarding fetal tissue donation and how that is allowed to potentially have certain entities profit from the selling and harvesting of that fetal tissue. So I passed a bill that would prohibit fetal tissue donation for profit from elective abortions. To that bill were added some other pieces of legislation regarding disposition of fetal remains, as well as a prohibition of late-term abortions.
FYI, just so you know, we are a nation of different states. On August the 16th, Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a bill to provide free abortions to all, including illegal immigrants. Under the first-of-its-kind law, most of which goes into effect immediately, Oregon insurers must provide 100% coverage for abortions without copays or deductions. So it's a different world in that sense. I want to give you 1 minute to wrap up. Anything we didn't cover that's important to you that you'd like to share with? Yes. Oh, I was going to start here. 1 minute wrap up of anything that we haven't covered today that's important to you.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to clarify Clint's one statement. Marcy's had to endure me for 25 years, so I apologize. Okay. To water, one of the most significant things for our economic opportunities as well. You look at some of the progressive things we're working on the Natural Resources Committee as we watch the number, we're just going to say trillions, run back into the Gulf right now. Yes, our prayers and thoughts with everybody that were damaged by those floodwaters, but we have no way of capturing that. The bills that would allow us to study our aquifers and how we could store that were all vetoed. So one of the biggest disappointments along with not funding the public education was the lack of water legislation that passed, because that will guarantee our future. And if you watch the Western Desert move closer and closer to 35, how are we going to move that water across to our friends on the other side of 35?
Representative Rainey.
First of all, I would like to mention a couple things that I think somewhat are concerning. Out of that $217 billion that we have as a budget, about a little over half of it comes from the federal government. And out of that total budget, there's only somewhere around 17% which we have any control over. The other monies are already designated. And I think it's very critical. We get lambasted because we don't do something about the budget. But when we only have 17% that we have much control over, it makes it very difficult. And I think that's an important thing for you to know. I'd like to say a couple things about higher education. We did add money to higher education. We added a bunch of money to GMEs, and I know Dr. Swartner is interested in that. That's graduate medical education. We have done some things with community colleges that will allow some of them to give four-year degrees, and I think that we're probably going to need to expand that. And I have worked on legislation of transparency and have a team set up with community colleges that are going to look at making sure that there is some method that the community colleges can report their expenditures by campus. And I think that would be, in the end result, will be a better opportunity for community colleges to sell their very good programs to members of the legislature and get some more money out of it. So I think we've had a good year in higher ed, and I think we have had a decent year with the budget, with the restrictions that we have. And I look forward to next session, and I appreciate y'all being here to listen to us.
Senator.
Thank you. And thank you all for your attention. And it's an honor to serve with these two fine gentlemen. You know, Kyle with his knowledge of rural issues and agriculture issues as well as water. And then and Representative Rainey with his higher education focus and business focus. You have a very experienced delegation. It's my honor to serve, I guess, now three terms or three sessions as your state senator. This last session was my most important focus and priority was reforming our child protective services. It was an issue that was brought to light because of certain tragedies in which children were not timely investigated, and secondarily, children that were extracted from a bad setting and left languishing in a bad situation, either in group settings or, unfortunately, actually in CPS offices. So we needed to really dive deep in that issue, and I want to really applaud the entire legislature for working in a bipartisan fashion to pass significant legislation that hopefully will reform our CPS system and make sure that those children are properly investigated, that they're taken care of, that they're that the adequacy of the network of providers in our state is rejuvenated, and we put significant resources as well as policy changes in place. And then secondarily, mental health, working with my fellow deskmate, Flor Price, who's now chair of public health on the House side. But when I came in on the House, he and I sat next to each other on the House floor. He's an attorney from Amarillo, a great guy. But we worked together on certain grant programs to address some mental health challenges, especially in rural counties and rural-ish areas in which they had certain deficiencies, to allow for them to utilize that money to fill those voids. As well as rejuvenation of our state hospital system. We have 10 state hospitals, and every single county commissioner and county judge and law enforcement individual understands just how difficult, an ER individual understands just how difficult it is to get individuals with mental health challenges and disorders to the proper location to be treated by the proper individual in a timely fashion. And we started that process. It's a six-year process. It's going to take significant resources. I led the charge to try to get $300 million from our ESF, our rainy day fund, and was successful in that to start the process to build new state hospitals, Rusk and H down in Houston, but Ash is on the way, as well as San Antonio. Kerrville is actually on the design phase this session, but it'll take three different sessions, 6 years to get it all done. But I hope that's my legacy, if I can stay here long enough to finish that legacy. I thank you for the honor to serve you, and appreciate your attention.
Before Glenn makes some closing comments, please thank our guests for being here today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you, guys. Man, I think you'll agree with me that we are truly blessed to have men of this caliber representing us in Austin. And I thank you guys. I know you work hard every day. And what Scott DeLucia, who better to ask the probing questions and to ask the questions that we're all thinking out here than Scott? So you just gave him a round of applause. But one more time for me, for all four of these guys. And Scott, thank you.